Welcome back to Gentlemen Prefer Bonds. I'm Will Daniel.
And I'm Will Schlick.
And I'm Max Wilcox.
Today we're continuing our series of films that feel Bond-inspired or Bond-adjacent to us with 1999's The Thomas Crown Affair. It's based on the 1968 film of the same name, directed by Norman Jewison and starring Steve McQueen and Faye Dunaway. And of course, we're covering the 99 one because it is starring our boy Pierce Brosnan, right in the middle of his run as James Bond. Comes out the same year as The World Is Not Enough, and is, as you may remember, the reason why Christmas Jones is not an insurance investigator. The original Steve McQueen wanted to do that movie because he basically wanted to play a guy in a suit, since he'd become a movie star, you know, playing cowboys and soldiers and criminals and stuff. And obviously Thomas Crown is a criminal, but very high class and suave. And honestly, Steve McQueen totally doesn't completely work for me in that movie. I think he obviously good looking and charismatic.
Looks great in the suit. Got the suit, bought the suit, was in the suit, was good in the suit.
I wrote the theme song, sang the theme song. It doesn't totally sell me in that movie. Whereas I think Pierce Brosnan in the 90s as Thomas Crown is just genius casting. Bit obvious casting, but really works. So I wanted to jump right into the James Bond of it all. And really, what other Bonds do you think could have played this part?
Any of them? I think Thomas Crown to me is just clean. Thomas Crown to me is clean Bond. I think to varying levels of success, all of them could have been Thomas Crown.
Kind of. It's clean Bond, but it's also like... this year is the 30th anniversary of Fatal Attraction, and a couple of podcasts I listened to covered that, and I watched that movie again. This movie is like a safe, you know, non-murdery version of Basic Instinct, where Rene Russo is Michael Douglas, who's like, I'm gonna nail this suspect, and Pierce Brosnan is Sharon Stone, who's like, what if we had a lot of sex instead?
Yeah.
And there's a blue dance club scene in both movies.
That's a valid point. Good job. Well yeah. Done. But no.
Could you see Daniel Craig in this?
Yes. Easily. Very easily. So?
Interesting.
I think I could see really any of the Bonds in this movie. I think the biggest stretch for me would probably be T-Dalt.
Yeah.
Because this character is sort of all charm, and he didn't have what I would call it, and he was an exuding charm all the time.
He would have been the Faye Dunaway character.
Yeah, he would have been the Faye Dunaway character, or the Dennis Leary character,
or the Dennis Leary character. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I guess my point was just that I feel like Connery and Brosnan have like the most movie star quality to play a role like this kind of effortlessly.
I think that Connery, I don't think, is even at the top for me for who would work between Bond and here, because his is a rough suaveness.
Yeah.
So I would put above him. Pierce Brosnan, I think, is the number one. And then right after him would be Captain Old Pants. I'm tired. Who am I thinking of?
Roger Moore.
Roger Moore. Thank you. The world's oldest Bond. That's forever.
True.
Literally, because time only goes forward. He will forever be the world's oldest James Bond.
Yeah, that's true. I don't think we're bringing Pierce back for one more time.
You could, though. You could
no,
pull
I know.
Like,
we all want to, yeah.
God, you could pull like a what was the Sherlock Holmes one with Ian McKellen, where he plays
old Holmes.
Like, you could do could do
it was
old
called
Bond.
Sherlock Old.
You could do old Bond, Jameson, and with a Pierce Brosnan. I would watch the shit out of that.
Yeah, I'm in for that. So this movie came out August 6th, 1999. Made I think 124 million budget of 48. Not a huge hit, but certainly made its money back. I'm betting probably did decent haul home video as well. Directed by John McTiernan, famous wiretapper.
Yeah, my favorite my favorite convicted felon who yeah. also directs movies.
Yeah. He was like still pretty hot at this time, but had kind of an uneven 90s.
Yeah,
I think him being on board helped sell this movie, but also he's coming off like 13th Warrior and Last Action Hero.
I thought 13th Warrior was after this. Maybe it wasn't.
I think it's like maybe 96, 97.
97, yeah, okay. So, yeah, Last Action Hero is kind of fun.
No, I'm not saying either of those are particularly bad. Yeah. They just weren't successful. I was going to say,
parts of 13th Warrior are actually quite good.
Yeah.
The movie doesn't work, but parts of 13th Warrior are awesome.
I would call this probably the end of the road for him. I don't think he ever does anything really after this. I know he probably has one or...
the same year. It's also 99.
Oh, okay. Wow.
It comes out in August of 99.
Oh, wow. When did this come out?
Oh, August of 99.
Wow, that's same month.
That's crazy.
That is awesome. You know what? I change everything I've ever said. McTiernan for president. McTiernan
He's
for
the
life.
Greatest man.
Yeah. Well, I think he only does like actors. Two movies after. Yeah, sorry, Max, go on.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say that happens with actors a decent amount, but like, how often does it happen with directors? That they have the same movie coming out in the same month, yeah. Let alone year.
Yeah, there's only a handful of times where a director's had two movies in the same year. We did a podcast about one of them, Soderbergh, and I can't think of too many more.
Spielberg's had like three of those.
Spielberg has had that a lot. Hitchcock, I'm sure, had that.
Yeah, and anyone like pre-60s when
yeah,
they were
sure.
cranked out. Exactly.
Cranking them out, yeah. Yeah, in the modern era, there's not too many. Obviously, McCarthy with The Cobbler and Spotlight.
Obviously, we were all thinking of The Cobbler.
What? Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
The first thought on my mind when I wake up in the morning is The Cobbler.
Yeah, The Cobbler.
What would The Cobbler
Adam
do?
Sandler? Yeah. it's a fun movie. I haven't really... I don't know... what your all's experience with it is, but I have not seen it very much. I probably watched it on TV a couple of times as a kid. It was a kind of a TNT classic or
yeah.
USA or
yeah.
something.
Me too.
And that's about all I really remember of it.
I think I bought the VHS for like a dollar at a yard sale when I was probably in middle school or high school and expected it to be more of a James Bond movie and was kind of bored, and then watched it a few years ago and enjoyed it a lot more.
Yeah, it's definitely not very Bondian outside of the fact that
Pierce Brosnan
being
cool
in
it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's... I don't even know how to describe it, really. I guess it's kind of a drama. Like
it's a romantic heist movie, I guess.
Yeah.
It's
a romeistedy.
Let me just put it this... You would never see this movie get made today. In any form.
You don't think Netflix would spend $20 million on making this as a streamer?
Maybe. You don't see it very often, I'd say. I can't recall many movies like this in the last 10 years.
Call Ocean's 11 a romeistacy.
Yeah, yeah. You forget the first movie part of the goal.
Get
Julia
romance.
Roberts back.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think though that has elements of like a buddy comedy, which is still a little bit more pop, maybe not as much now, but like
yeah, it's a lot of things.
Yeah,
but it's both of those are following up from like Sneakers, like you mentioned, as like these the fun kind of carefree heist movies. It's yeah. the counterpoint to your Michael Manns and stuff, where the stakes couldn't be higher.
I also would like to point out that there's the Dennis Leary Frankie Faison buddy cop comedy that's clearly they're having a good time.
Yeah, they clearly have a good working relationship.
Frankie Faison can deliver exposition like no one else on earth. Faison can look at you dead in the face and be like, this is exactly what you need to know for the rest of the movie to make sense. And now I'm just going to sort of smirk in the corner and you're going to pay me my $1 million.
I don't know if he got paid $1 million for this movie.
If he didn't, it's a crime.
Do you think Dennis Leary's character thinks that Rene Russo's gonna get her heart broken and rebound with him?
Yes, definitely.
See, and that's the interesting part. I think that that's the way that Dennis Leary plays it. I don't think that's the way it's supposed to be written.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. Like, it, I think it's supposed to feel like brotherly, weirdly. And it does, and like, he chose in that last scene to play it like she's gonna like choose him in a way that none of the rest of the movie sort of foretells.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of a weird ending to me a little bit, because that's like sort of the maximum moment of this like pseudo romance between the Dennis Leary character and her, and then she just sort of still runs off with Thomas Crown, and it's kind of leaves you feeling a bit weird about the whole thing.
To me, though, that's what I'm saying, is that I think that's Dennis Leary's fault. Like, it doesn't read to me, the scenes they have together don't read romantic. They read like Dennis Leary is getting a new work part, like cop partner.
Like, yeah, no,
I
agree. I that ending scene, even the way it's written, like Dennis Leary's performance aside, there's like, I don't think he wrote her kissing him, and like,
sure.
Yeah.
The kiss.
I was surprised by that. I forgot that and was like, that's a little weird.
Yeah, it's weird.
Couldn't hug or kiss on the cheek.
A lot of the Rene Russo of it all is weird in this movie. Let's be honest.
Okay, so do you not like her in this movie?
No, I think she's fine. I think she's fine. I would have preferred many other people. But Catherine, I say Taylor that Jones. I could say that as about almost any Rene Russo performance.
Really, I like Rene Russo. I always find her to give like a good, interesting performance. And
she, to me, is the picture of this thing that happens where like an act, you suddenly think that an actor is like established, is not the right word. Obviously, she's established. She's been in way more shit than I or 99% of the population has been in. But like, she went from being brand new to being like commonplace and or household. Let me put it this way: Pierce Brosnan has been in like 90 movies, something like that. How many movies do you think that Rene Russo has been in?
Oh, not many. Probably like 12 to 15.
Above the title, like starring roles, maybe.
Yeah, like I always think of her.
You can go total. You can go total.
Are you looking at her total like IMDb credits?
Even then, I looked at all of them, and I can give you the like, I won't give you like a guest star on like a TV show. I won't give you anything like that. And I can tell you like how many she's been in.
Theatrical movies that she starred in, you're saying?
I don't think the word star has to, like, did she star in the Thor movies? No, but she's in them. I don't think the word star is fair to necessarily place.
Yeah, she doesn't star in The Line of Fire, but she's definitely in that movie.
You're about dead right. It's like 24 movies. It's like 23 to 25 movies. Which, again, that is not a small amount of movies, but when you think about the fact that like Dennis Leary has been in like only like 10 less movies than her, like, it is weird to me that Rene Russo is placed in all of our minds as this sort of like ultra like need to be respected classic established whatever.
I think you're putting words into our mouths, sure, or minds here.
But like, my point being, this is one of the, I think, the easier movies for us to say like this could have probably been 7 different people. In fact, yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if Rene Russo was maybe not even first on the list.
Well, I think the issue that maybe it feels like Rene Russo has a pretty by her own choice down 2000s of not really working much. I don't know if it's like raising kids or something. We talk about a little bit of Natalie.
She also
Portman,
got
but,
famous when she was like 35, yeah, which is way but, later than most
but
actresses.
But she's in a ton
so.
Of stuff in the 90s. I mean, yeah.
Lethal
Major
Weapon
League,
movies.
Lethal Weapon, Tin Cup, which I love. This obviously is the end of the 90s.
Sure.
Yeah. I just don't think she... I think she could have been way more prominent. I have a feeling that she just didn't really work much in the 2000s. Again, I don't know the reasons why, but maybe it was raising kids, or I know she's married to Dan Gilroy, who did Nightcrawler, right?
Yeah, I think so.
And so I don't know if she just spent some time maybe raising their family together while he was working, and they had that sort of, but she was big in the 90s. I can see why she's still a big deal.
Yeah, I don't know the history of this movie. I mean, you'd think in 99 they're probably trying to get Julia Roberts or probably a handful of names before they land on her. But she still feels like a catch in 99.
Yeah.
So that leads to one of my more fun questions, which is, you are casting this in 99. Who do you cast?
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I was thinking about casting this now or like alternate 60s, maybe 90. Well, okay. So we're sticking with Brosnan, right?
Yeah, easily. I think you have to. I don't think there is in 99. I don't think there is a clear choice.
I think there's other guys. I think George Clooney in 99 could have pulled it off for sure.
Oh, no. Oh, I think there are other people that could have done it. I don't think if you're a studio, you necessarily aim for someone that isn't him.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I think I think he's probably the number one.
This is one of the last years where getting Brosnan might cost you more than Clooney.
Yeah.
Okay, so, yeah, I mean, I Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Thought about that one. Catherine Zeta-Jones at this point is about 15 years to 16 years younger than Pierce Brosnan.
But that's what we're doing with all the Bonds, and I don't think she, you know, her in Zorro is, you know, young and beautiful, but it doesn't, she's not like a kid. Like, it's not Keira Knightley in Pirates or something. Like, I don't sure. think it feels gross, her with him.
It's not about grossness. I think it's about career success. Mm-hmm. She is supposed to be the preeminent insurance sort of guru, which is why I do like that Rene Russo is the same age as Pierce Brosnan.
But Faye Dunaway can't be much older than 30 in the original. And I think you always believed her as like a professional.
Yeah, I think you have to consider that role a little bit. Like, the role is written as like a top-notch career, you know, insurance investigator. They kind of, I don't know if it's because she's in it or what, but they kind of write in that she's like, you know, been around the block a little bit with having been married and then, you know, divorced. I guess they hinted that. I don't know if you can cast someone much younger than her, really, that pulls
that
off.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
No, I think it's your point.
Yeah. Woman who would have been around 40 as they're filming this, Linda Fiorentino, would have been pretty awesome, I think. Yeah, The Last Seduction. Have you ever seen that?
No.
She's a sexy lady.
Yeah. She's a pretty lady.
but she's, yeah. I mean, The Last Seduction is kind of her, like, Basic Instinct movie, but it's what's his name who made like Red Rock West and like pretty great indie filmmaker. It's a cool movie. Yeah.
Who would you cast?
I watched this with some friends of mine, and this is not who I would choose, but I do think it is an excellent choice because I don't particularly like them, but I think they'd be really, really good. And they also didn't really do a whole lot this year. Michelle Pfeiffer.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Correct age.
Yeah,
she's probably right there.
She's right about Brosnan's age, I'm sure.
Again, it is one of the, I am weirdly replacing a person I didn't love with a person I don't love, but I do think Michelle Pfeiffer is maybe a bit stronger than Rene Russo.
I'd throw Kim Basinger in there. I'm just thinking about her at post LA Confidential.
Sure.
Feels like a movie that would have been right around that, she would have been right around the perfect age for at that point. Could pull it off.
Yeah, Pfeiffer has What Lies Beneath come out the year after this. She's still, yeah, I mean, still pretty huge 20 years ago. Yeah, I think.
Oh, just cast Faye Dunaway in it again. Just have it be more of a.
Yeah, bigger role than she has in this.
Oh, you mean her role as the
therapist?
As the therapist that laughs at her client?
Yeah. the worst therapist ever.
The therapist who makes fun of her client on a pretty regular basis.
Yeah. And who like just totally demeans him for all of his choices. And like obviously doesn't like him. I love when she's like, when you're looking away, you're usually thinking about something naughty.
She's definitely wants to fuck him. Hilarious. Her role in this is such a weird choice to, like, they start the movie, wait, right? They start the movie with them. And then, but, like, it never, it's, I get that it's a cool framing device because you can treat it as sort of maybe even just his internal dialogue, but, like, it is the weirdest thing to cut from this movie, these two different sort of movies, this weird miniseries with Pierce Brosnan and Faye Dunaway, and then the rest of the movie.
Yeah, it's like I'm watching an episode of In Treatment in between this movie. It's so odd.
Yeah, because
it's
like I'm watching. Yeah. After the opening credits, they only do one or two. Like, he has like 2 30-second spots with her in the middle.
And they never, it's never like, he never ever justifies even a little bit of like, I have to go, darling, I have a meeting, and then cut to the therapist. Like, it, there's a world where she doesn't exist. There's a world where he's doing that to, like, in his own mind.
Yeah.
That is so funny. I love that theory for this movie, that it's just his internal monologue.
Yeah, because, like, why would this man who is trying to not betray any amount of weakness, right? Why would he be with a therapist? Like, he would be his own therapist. If I make this movie today, I'm, like, I'm trying really hard to let the audience know that, like, it is entirely possible that, like, this man has never seen a therapist. He imagines what a therapist would say to you.
If Rene Russo walks into the room and he's just, like, lying down on a couch talking to himself, and that's, like,
hilarious.
A doll with a wig on.
It's like, more of a psycho vibe. Like, it's a skeleton with a wig on it.
And she's like, how does that make you feel?
She was like, I was really okay with the massive amounts of crime. I cannot handle this. This, I'm sorry, I'm done. I want to know why Dennis Leary is wearing such a revealing hairstyle.
I do. I got to know more about his. Really. You know, he's got a suit that's like two sizes too big.
Did you see the title in the end credits that comes up pretty fast about, like, This movie was not shot in a museum. Museums are not cool with this movie. Like,
oh, you bet I did. I laughed so hard at that. I wanted to be
real clear about, don't try this shit at home.
Don't take a briefcase filled with titanium girders inside of it and put it in the doorway of a museum.
Yeah, don't paint over a Monet.
Let's go back to the very beginning. I like this movie. It is fun. What do both of you think of this movie?
I would say the same. I think it's a blast from the past, a fun 90s romp. It's, you know, definitely pretty not a lot of substance, but I think it totally gets the job done for what they're going for.
Yeah, it's a real, to me, like a real old school movie. It feels like a 60s movie, actually, in a lot of ways, and they're kind of using that playbook. And I'd point out, to me, the thing that makes me really like it is the last, and like a lot of 60s movies and older movies, they're all kind of slow burns, but they usually have really, really great finales. The finale of this is really cool. The final scene in the museum that it all sort of builds towards, and you're kind of like, oh, okay, I get it now. Like, I'm a little, like, I'm not sure I wanted to watch an hour and 30 minutes to get to this point, but it was a cool ending, and I like the movie.
I feel like it's, like, I brought up Basic Instinct before. It sort of feels like the bridge movie between, like, the Adrian Lynn and, like, Paul Verhoeven, like, sex thrillers and, like, a more family-friendly, like, Ocean's 11. Like, there's definitely, you know, you get the R-rated sex scene in this, and I think it's supposed to be a sexy movie and part of that, but it's not, you know, murder is not part of the equation of the stakes or anything.
Yeah.
Does it also feel like maybe Rene Russo wanted to be nude? Like, there is, more nudity than was necessary in a way that, like, I feel like she was like, and then maybe in this scene I'm also beach, naked.
Yeah. Yeah, and they're like, her just being randomly naked on the beach was like, it's like she looked into the future and saw Halle Berry and Swordfish and was like, I want to do that. Like, and then, not really necessary, but
and then like she when then, naked. Yeah, and then when she was like, and I'll be naked, and then Pierce Brosnan, who doesn't have as much confidence, was like, yeah, and I'll enter in a sarong. And they're yeah. like, you mean a woman's sarong? And he goes, yes, I want to enter in a black woman's sarong to the beach. And it's like, great. You mean like to imply that you're naked because it's not swim trunks? Yes. And it's like, but we won't see you naked. No.
That feels, I think Pierce Brosnan's a little bit self-conscious about his body.
Do you think it's maybe his real butt in this movie? Or
I can't
or
imagine.
A double.
I have to imagine a double.
I would take a double.
I want it to be Brosnan ass. I want it to be really bad. But I think that because it is quite a nice ass.
It's good ass.
It's a nice ass. I yeah, have to think
we're all
maybe.
Hoping that.
I hope that that's Bond's ass. But I kind of think that that's like a pro.
Yeah. When are they going to let Bond hang dong in a movie? It's time, guys.
Hey, wake up. Logan made like $600 million. Just make a $100 million Bond movie. Yeah. Hard R.
Ben Affleck showed dong and like revitalized his whole career.
Yeah.
When did Ben Affleck show dong?
You get some side dong in Gone Girl.
Gone Girl.
Oh, you get side dong in Gone Girl?
Were you not paying attention?
Were you not on the
blogs?
Were
you looking at Rosamund Pike?
or crap, who's the other model that's in it?
Tyler Perry's also in the shower with them.
Oh, well, that's
you forgot about
Robert.
That.
Yeah,
forgot about that scene, yes.
Boy, I do not remember him hanging side dong in that movie. Very cool.
I respect
See, Bond
him
people
for
pay,
that.
Pay attention. We're all liking this.
We're really just doing Mr. Skin's job for them.
Yeah, if we could just pull out of our hats a minute and second mark for Gone Girl. But I about this actual movie that we're talking about, the opening heist sequence feels good and great. I want one more. I feel like they missed the rule of three on the heist scenes where.
There should
you
be
get
a thing
the,
in the middle.
Yeah, you get the Magritte like man with the hat and the necktie at the end, which is also an awesome scene, especially because they obviously hint at it with it being in his apartment, et cetera, et cetera. You're missing one in the middle. That I really want. And I guess you could kind of say that it's Rene Russo breaking into his house, but like that isn't it. That's not.
Yeah, it doesn't feel the
it's
same.
It's not enough.
It's not the same character perpetuating it. So yeah.
So it's like I want one more. I want one more right in the middle that really truly establishes how skilled he is.
Yeah, it feels like Mission Impossible. If it's like you know they've got the opening assassination in Prague, and then the train thing at the end, and it's like we need a Langley. Like
yeah, exactly. I want some middle bit that proves because like it the beginning scene is really cool. It's a fantastic classic heist scene. I like them coming out of the horse. You get the decent thing where you get a not James Bond where you get a Mission Impossible like one guy has to be in pain because the mission's so important. Like that whole opening scene is pretty great. But once again, he strolls in right at the end. Which does show that he's intelligent, but it does not show why and how he has reasonably done this before. Like, we never truly get a setup that shows you that Thomas Crown did not steal this one piece of art. Thomas Crown is a gentleman thief on the level of a Lupin. Not Lupin the Third. What is the super famous Saints? French character?
Oh. Boy, from which movie?
From Lupin and the story, and also from the television series that just came out on Netflix. Oh. But it's like it is a very very famous television. Sorry, it's a very famous book series from the.
Like, let's just say Cary Grant as the cat in To Catch a Thief.
Do neither of you know anything about Arsene Lupin? You read all your Tintin nonsense.
When I was eight, yeah.
I've seen your room.
I only watched Ren Tin Tin about the dog that was running around. I like Ren Tin Tin.
They're related.
Yeah.
Arsene Lupin is technically the inspiration for Thomas Crown as well. The whole point is that he was a French gentleman art thief who couldn't possibly be the thief because he is actually a wealthy like art collector. It's this character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is just a French novel series of a heist things.
It is odd that there's no line where Dennis Leary is like, you know, also we're missing Monet's water lilies and like we've got, you know, these other haystacks or whatever there should be a list of like missing paintings.
Yeah, or you'd like to hear a little bit about like, hey, this guy, look, we kind of know about this guy, and there's some things that have happened, and he's been a suspect, but no one can ever get him on anything.
Mm-hmm.
They maybe don't do a good enough job of creating the Thomas Crown backstory in this movie. This might be one where you want to get a little bit more of, like, what did this guy do, like, prior to this in terms of heist, in terms of learning about his... this is probably actually... You take everything that's in this movie and give it to a writer in like 2016, it's probably a way better movie. When just a little bit more in touch with like psychology in movies and how you're sort of, you know, analyzing characters. They don't do a great job of that in this.
It does lead me to, which is, this is why I made such a big weird sound when you said you didn't think they could make this movie now. I think, personally, when I was watching this movie again, that this movie is such a blank canvas, such a sort of nothing movie in a good way, that I think this movie should be remade every 30 years.
I didn't say they couldn't remake. I said they wouldn't remake it now. But I do agree that I think they should.
Like, yeah. Maybe you're right that they wouldn't do it, like, pound for pound. But, like, I would totally watch a... more character-driven version of this that came out right now.
Well, I just think the financial proposition is not good enough. You're right. They absolutely should. I think it'd be a better movie with coming out in 2014. Someone probably writes an unbelievable version of this.
Yeah.
You know?
You could even do like a six-part... You could do like an HBO six-part TV show BS.
Yeah, and like get into the psychology of his... Like one of the things I'm a little bit thrown by is like this guy obviously has... Anyone who's compelled to steal probably has some issues, right?
They have some reason, yeah.
Yeah, you kind of never really get the reason for it. You kind of never really get into his psychology at all, which kind of leaves you with a weird disconnect about him as a character and Rene Russo's attraction to him. Like, is she just in love with a psychopath? Is that what she likes?
I think the implication in both movies is that he's just bored and there's nothing, you know... He hasn't really been able to connect to people until the perfect woman comes along, that is. And that's like, you know, he's worth billions. Like, his life, he needs the excitement of...
Let's analyze that a little bit more. What is that?
Exactly. See? Thank you.
Bored is not really a state of mind. I mean, that's just I get bored and I don't go steal art.
This is why I want it. This is why I want a new Thomas Crown every 30 years. Which means... 2029.
Yeah. Boredom doesn't really make people steal.
All I'm saying is the first one came out in 1968. The next one came out in 1999. If in the year 2030 we get a Thomas Crown movie, I'm going to be so jazzed. I'm going to be absolutely freaking like amazed and excited.
Okay, so cast this movie for 2022.
Rene Russo is... No.
She could play the therapist.
She definitely would play the therapist, yes.
Are we saying he's going to hang dong in whatever we're casting? Because that's going to...
Yes.
Oh, yeah, so Fassbender.
Obviously.
Fassbender.
He would be really good. Yeah. How old is he?
Yeah, he's like mid-40s now.
Yeah. Because you have to be... Brosnan was 45, exactly.
Yeah, that's probably how old Fassbender is.
Fassbender is 45, exactly.
Yeah.
So you could do Fassbender. I also think Idris Elba, also good casting for this.
Yeah. Sure.
Also a man who's dong I'd love to see. So we're going two for two on that.
Oh, one. So you're going the wishful thinking dong hanging thing, yeah.
I think that if the dong fits, then I'll take it.
Yeah. If I'm casting this movie right now, I'm asking the male lead to obviously get naked in the room. You got to see if he can hang dong.
But and I also think that we do exactly the thing we would be called woke for, which is that like male actor hanging dong, female actor you don't get nudity.
Yeah.
No female nudity, just dong.
No, she's wearing a burqa the whole
She's wearing
movie.
The burqa. Thank you. She's
and he's just naked the whole time.
He's just naked.
He's going to business meetings naked.
Just like he's so eccentric.
when he signs the paper and they tell him like, "Wow, you finally did it," and he's like, and Fassbender's like, "Wait until you have to go tell your bosses I would have done it for $15 million less," and they're like, "Whoa, his dick is huge." who's What 40-year-old? I have a thought, but she's honestly probably too big for this. So y'all think about it first.
Well, do we actually settle on a male? The jokes aside,
I think Fassbender would or Idris Elba would both be the two top contenders.
I agree. Who's your
like
who's your nominee?
Oh, I'm good with either of those.
Like Tom Hardy is also a maybe.
Oh, I was gonna say Tom Green. From Freddy Got Fingered.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Would be the only.
Yeah, you mean Tom Green, who was married to Drew Barrymore?
Yeah, that Tom Green.
What was I thinking? Oh yeah, the guy who's the forger, who's his dad, looks a lot like Sean Connery.
Sure does. Sure. Wait, but back
just,
to the
just a random. Okay,
back to
how do you feel about Anne Hathaway?
See, I think she'd be really good. I think this is also a perfect time in her career. It's she's trying a little bit of a comeback right now because she stopped for a while because she had a kid. Congratulations, good for her. And I think that would be a good one. My that is who I think is it would really be. If you made this movie to be an Oscar contender, then Emily Blunt would be amazing in this.
Ooh. I mean, they both make.
But I think she's
fun
too.
Movies too.
I think she's but... too true. But I think Emily Blunt is maybe too big to be. Like, if you make this movie even now, it has to be very similar. Where like you make it for not more than 100 mil. Like it has to be relatively cheap.
I don't. She
probably,
doesn't
it might
push
be
the budget
be
above 100 mil.
Renee Russo's red hair leaking through, but. People, I think like Jessica Chastain would do it really well.
Oh yeah, sure.
I'm just thinking about like Molly's Game and
sure.
Are you sure you're not thinking of Bryce Dallas Howard
from
Lady
Jurassic
in the Water?
World Dominion? Yeah, or Lady in the Water? Yeah, okay, either one. Yeah, well, she'd be great too. Well, let's throw Amy Adams in there too. Let's.
Yeah, she could do it.
Yeah, Amy Adams.
Let's just throw Amy Schumer in there too. Let's just get all the Amys, all the Toms.
Amy Sedaris, it's done. Idris Elba, Amy Sedaris.
I would love.
I would
Amy
watch
Sedaris
the shit out of that. If she just played it straight, that would be so good. That'd be hilarious. Now, the most important part: who's playing Dennis Leary?
Ooh.
My cousin from Kentucky, who's 15, whose mom cuts his hair.
I'm going. If I'm going a comedian, Ricky Gervais.
Could Ricky Gervais have a bowl cut though? I don't know.
I hope not. I don't know how you could make that. That sounds atrocious. Let's see who fits that the like little bit of a comedian, little bit. Oh, Sugar! You know exactly who it is. If you stick with a person who is a comedian but is also weirdly does a lot of dramatic roles, it's Bill Burr. The cop is Bill Burr.
Yeah, Bill Burr.
That like, works. Yeah.
That is like that is such a good fit.
I think
if we can't afford him, we just go Louis C.K. Call it a day.
His film career is going well right now.
Touching that one.
I was already Ricky Gervais was already my like risque joke. Yeah. I didn't need us to go farther.
I don't know if I'm dialed enough.
Screw it. Let's get both of them on there, and let's just go ahead and burn this thing to the ground. Make sure that every press conference is just about people being about cancel culture. That's wonderful now.
Ricky Gervais and Louis C.K., you're saying?
Yeah, screw it. Let's just cast both of them. We'll cast both of them. Let's get
character.
Did Ricky Gervais get canceled? Did I miss that?
No, it's that Ricky Gervais does nothing but talk relentlessly about cancel culture despite never having been canceled and making
he gets millions of dollars.
That does not equal canceling. Canceling means that you don't get to do your job. And he, if not mistaken, makes more money than almost any comedian.
Certainly. Bill Conti does the score for this movie, which I like, but better than Bill Conti's score, great use of Nina Simone's Sinner Man. A couple key moments.
So good.
Just fucking really cool.
Yeah.
I also say that this score is like he was dared that he couldn't put every genre in one movie.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Bill Conti has a style, and it's like very apparent. Like,
yeah.
You're watching the first. He did Rocky, right?
Yes.
Like, you're watching the first 10 minutes of this movie, and you're like, "Wait, is this kind of like exactly like the Rocky theme song?"
I didn't get Rocky. I got like some of his. I got like broadcast news or something. It's like bum 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 bum.
Yeah, it's like it's all like
it's very like carefree music. Like it feels like the big score or something. Yeah. I like the music. It doesn't always fit this movie. Like it feels like, you know, David Holmes did, you know, the Ocean's movies, like would have really killed this.
Yeah.
But the use of like the couple times without even playing like any of the vocal parts, just like the kind of bridge, like piano breakdown of Sinner Man, dun 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 bum 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 bum. It's like it feels like it's just the score to the movie.
Yeah,
really cool.
If you were a billionaire gentleman thief and you could steal one piece of art,
that's a good question.
What piece of art are you stealing? He has chosen the haystacks because, quote, while he eats his croissant, just leave me with my haystacks. He loves his haystacks.
Wait, but no, I thought it was he's pretending to like the haystacks, but he gets the painting that's next to it.
No, he steals the haystacks. Right? No, he steals, right?
Well, no, in the
I don't
end,
know why
he steals
I don't
another
know why
photo.
No, he says everyone, no, the security guard says everyone goes for the Monet, which is the painting on
right. But they're all Monets. That is the part of the idiocy.
Oh,
of
yes, okay. They're
all
right.
Monets, yeah. They're all Monets, which is why that guard is a moron.
Right. Okay, but he doesn't... I thought he didn't get the one that he was staring directly at.
I believe he does, but I could be wrong, but I believe he does.
Because I thought that was like part of his cover, is that like... Oh, like the guard would say, like he didn't even like that painting.
Well, if that was a part, then it's not in the script and it didn't come up. If that part was part of the plan, that they pull in that guard who cares more about security than any guard I've ever seen at the Met, and I go at least twice a year. That dude was that. Can I just say real fast that every guard in this version of the Met cares so much more and is so much nicer. I have gotten really close to a painting at the Met before, just like that little girl does. And all that happened to me is that from 30 feet away, a person said, "No touching." Like, very different experience for Max at the Met than for this little girl at the Met.
After they said no touching, did you give the painting a little kiss?
Every time I am in a museum, I try to touch at least one thing.
When I was a kid, I would run around in the Met and like pull open the drawers to like the ancient like European tables, and I think I got yelled at a lot as like a 4-year-old in the Met.
Yeah, I feel like the times that I went to art museums as a child, I always got yelled at. Because I would just like barely almost try to touch a picture and they'd be like, no. Or my parents would just yell at me for doing that. And then either way, it was bad. There was no good. There was no winning element there.
Would you just go up to all the nudes and just
Touch the right in the nipple?
Yeah. Just right in the nipple.
Basically the pupil of the chest.
Yeah.
You are right, Will, that he was the painting that he steals, is called San Giorgio, Maggiore at dusk. And he was staring at Haystacks, which is the opposite one, which is like the same room, but opposite. And I was mistaken because the part where I am still about the one part, which is that guard is still an idiot because it's a room full of Monets, and he's like, people just look at the Monet.
So to answer your question, I'm pretty basic. I would take a classic landscape like a Monet or Renoir.
Just any of them? You don't have like one that's your favorite?
So my grandpa loved the water lilies, and he made a kind of arch bridge over the pond they have in Lake Champlain to look like the Monet paintings. So one of the water lilies, or just, I mean, there's so many classic landscapes that are really beautiful.
You're right that there are so many water lilies. I mean, even his main quote unquote water is massive. It takes up just like 40, 50, 60 feet. It's massive.
Did I say Renoir? I meant like Van Gogh also, like Starry Night or what's the daytime version of Starry Night?
Sunny Day.
Yeah.
Right? That's that tracks.
Yes, yeah, Sunny D, I think. Yeah.
Sunny D.
Wait, did you say what yours would be?
No, I did not. Since I asked the question, I should have gone first. To be nice. I have a couple. Maybe I would go with the thing is that this one would be a little easier because there's like just prints of it essentially. But I love Toulouse-Lautrec, an artist that did a lot of sort of quote unquote pop art that a lot of posters and whatnot. And he has these big, massive, beautiful posters that is just like people in motion having fun and whatnot. But if I had to choose one, I would probably choose a George Seurat. Probably not Sunday Afternoon because it is, one, I would not want to deprive the world of it. It's a beautiful painting. But
it's
two,
very large again.
It's, but yeah, exactly. But two, it is very, very big. But he, not only do I absolutely adore pointillism, but he did something really, really cool, which is that he also paints the frames of his pieces because he wanted the art to extend entirely. He wanted the entire piece to be encompassed by the art. And he paints in a way that's really mathematical. So he has another piece that's called The Circus that I really, really adore. He also did several pieces that were similar to, they were in the same theme of a circus, a French circus. So I would probably not take the main painting of The Circus. I would love to have one of the other pieces that was inspired by The Circus. Was that maybe too? I really like art. That may have been.
I love art. I have two that I would, and I would even go as far. I looked up where they're currently sitting in their
perfect
homes because they're both. It's fairly famous.
That's easier to get it from a private. They're in museums.
No, they're in museums. Okay. Yeah. So
they belong in a museum. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Yeah. One of them.
I would steal the cross of Coronado.
Yeah. No, these are both currently in museums. The first one's in the Louvre, which is Virgin on the Rocks by Da Vinci,
sure,
which I love. I love that a lot.
Gorgeous.
Gorgeous. I mean, very reminiscent of like Mona Lisa, but I think it's just a really cool. I took an art history class.
Mona
Lisa
is boring.
Mona Lisa is fucking ugly. Yeah. It would definitely not be the Mona Lisa.
Is ugly.
Oh, but I like Virgin on the well. So I didn't really know this. I guess
I didn't
there's two
mean
versions
as
of
in
it,
the woman.
But
still funny. She's just sitting there in her nightgown, yeah, being painted.
But I would steal Virgin on the Rocks from the Louvre. Virgin on the Rocks Prime. Apparently, there's multiple versions from the Louvre because that's my one of my favorite paintings of all time.
And I prefer Virgin straight up, but fine if you want Virgin on the Rocks.
Okay, fair enough. And then I'll go
Virgin with a twist.
Jan van Eyck Arnolfini portrait, which is in the National Gallery, which I love
too.
And I always love it because if you look in the pearl of the Arnolfini patron or whatever, you see Jan van Eyck painting in it. I always thought that was really cool.
I love and that. I love
that. That might not be that significant, but I just thought that's really cool. So if I had to have one, I got to choose one of those two.
That's
and
very
I,
cool. That's, those
and
are
I get
both
to go to
London choices.
Or Paris. Paris, yeah, and that's my
I
final statement
that.
On it.
I adore that. I felt I did similarly where I was thinking about the fact that the Syrah that I was talking about is in Musée d'Orsay, so I would also get to go to Paris. And I was also thinking about that. Is that fun bit?
Max, I recall a Halloween we spent together where you dressed as Son of Man.
Is this true?
I do recall that. I wasn't there, but I remember pictures.
Was that?
This is true.
In part to do with this movie, or were you just a big fan, regardless?
Neither of the above. I owned a suit and a red tie, and I am terrible at making plans. I owned a suit, a red tie, and a printer, and so I went out to a costume store, purchased an $8 bad bowler cap.
You were sort of the original Thomas Crown in my mind, I think, in a lot of ways.
Only what I stole was the hearts and minds of a generation.
Yeah.
Very clearly.
I wrote in my notes, Pierce Brosnan can't pronounce espresso. He does pronounce it correctly, and then when he says it a second time, he's like, do you want an espresso? And I was like,
you fucking
ingrate.
This man is clearly not
European. You should absolutely be able to know how to say that.
Yeah, you live a lot closer to Italy than we do.
Yeah, that's more of an American thing, the espresso thing.
Yeah, the second time he says it, he's like, how about that espresso? And Rene Russo's like, I don't need an espresso.
I would argue that she egregiously does. Did anyone else get the feeling that Rene Russo is playing the entire first half of the movie hungover?
Because just the sunglasses and
the massive sunglasses, the crazy smoothie where she's like, don't ask, it's jet lag. And then the next scene she has a bottle of water, and the next scene she has another liquid. She's drinking liquids through the first half of this movie like she's Brad Pitt in any movie with
Are you
snacks.
Talking about her the character or
her
the
character
actress?
No, her character, her character.
Oh, I
just forgot. I have already forgotten this character's name. It's not memorable to me.
I picked that up right away that she's hungover.
Yeah,
for
I think
most of the
I think this character drinks.
Yeah,
I think we got maybe a bit of a Giuliani situation with how her.
Yeah, I think the green
how her
the
face
green
melts.
Shake is like a dead giveaway.
Yeah. Also, this character was on Masked Singer, so.
Oh Lord, no! But that's the interesting part, right? They play to it so seriously, and then it is never brought up again, and we never see a scene or an explanation as to why it would happen because she says explicitly several times that it is jet lag, but it's like, is it supposed to be character development? She then drinks profusely through the rest of the movie and it's not an issue. Is it supposed to be like, if it's a Chekhov's gun, it never goes off. Therefore, it just comes across as sort of lazy.
I think she's an impulsive person, just like him, so her impulse is just over-drinking.
I think also they just want the most contrast and tension between her and the other cops, and her, she just comes in with a strong attitude before she can bond with Dennis Leary at the end.
Yeah. Sure, I'm just saying I get those things, but I'm just saying that it reads lazy. If you want her to come across as hostile, she can come in and already have more answers than you. That's normally what the choice is that the character comes in and they're more informed than the police and boss the police around without the police being able to do the thing. You can even already do that better because, like, shocker, she's a woman who's smart. So normally that is the choice. They set her up weirdly in a position of weakness by having her require this sort of special attention. I was just saying that it feels like an unfulfilled promise.
Sure. Well, should we go on to our remake lists, or anything else to say about Thomas Crown Affair?
Man, would they let you do anything on an airplane pre 9/11?
Yes. What? We forgot to talk about that.
What? Yeah, yeah.
That's a big part of this movie.
You can
climbing
do
over a
whatever
scene to jump on this guy.
Do whatever you want.
We're like, in the middle of, like, on the runway getting ready to fly off, and the flight attendant's just like, oh, that's so cute. She jumped over her seat.
And now they're off. Having sex.
Sorry, oh. I totally meant to bring that up and forgot it. That is a huge deal. Thank you, as that is a closing statement. Very fun.
Do you prefer this, or if you've seen the Norman Jewison 68 film, do you prefer that one?
I've never seen that.
Me neither.
I can't imagine there's any world where it's more fun to watch than this, just honestly.
Yeah, I found it a little slow.
Yeah.
Thoughts about Windmills in Your Mind, the Academy Award winning song from the original, which is redone. Actually, I don't know who sang it then.
Scene or whatever, yeah.
And I don't know who sings it in this one, but they play it at the credits as well in this one.
I can leave it.
Max, yep. Comments on Windmills of Your Mind?
I can't say it stood out to me even a little bit.
Yeah, not a great song. All right, I'll kick us off with here. And as we talked about in text a little, I'm defining this as movies that are based on older movies, even if there's an older text that maybe they're like inspired by, if the primary inspiration is the older movie, I'm counting it that way. So
or
like
a foreign
Casino
movie,
Rap.
We're gonna throw that in there, right?
Yes.
Well, I by older I mean at any pre-existing movie that it's based on. So foreign, domestic.
Yeah, I just want to. There is an adaptation vibe versus a straight remake. I think which is important to say because.
But it is, I agree with you completely, and I had the same question before you asked it, Road Warrior, was the concept there are plenty of things that are adaptations, and I think it falls in the same place that we talked about last time, where it feels like an umbrella under which two things fall.
So I know Dinner for Schmucks is on your list, then.
And mine, yes, obviously.
Well, that's why I was asking the question.
Yeah.
What did you think I was asking?
There's a difference between that and, like, you know, going, like, Pygmalion to My Fair Lady is like obviously more than a remake. So my first my number five favorite movie remake, 2005's King Kong by Peter Jackson, I think is a really fun movie. I think that's a good situation to do a remake, and obviously there already have been one. There's the Dino De Laurentiis movie from the 70s with Jeff Bridges and Jessica Lange. Pretty lame, that movie. And yeah, 2005, the guy who just made Lord of the Rings made perfect sense to, like, let's do this with modern special effects. I think there are there's certainly flaws. It's a little messy at times. I probably wouldn't have cast Adrian Brody or Jack Black maybe in those roles, but Naomi Watts is so good in it, and Andy Serkis is as Kong, and just a really fun, like, special effects monster movie that I find very rewatchable. What about you?
Well, so I have a couple honorable mentions, and I think that, is it worth doing those before or after? That's not really a spoiler, right?
Okay. Well, I think it might be smart to do them right before we do our number ones, because I think that for now, this might be our first list that I think actually has a decent amount of difference.
Yeah.
So it might be smart, because I also have some honorable mentions, and I think that it might be smart if we each do them before our number one, so that so that if somebody else said it, they can talk about it.
Okay. So my number five is The Fly by David Cronenberg.
Nice. Very nice.
Classic movie. I think that David Cronenberg is a very unique director from the standpoint that he's got his thing that he does that everyone knows him for, body horror or something. Occasionally he straddles the line of doing a movie that does like multiple things well, though. And The Fly is an unbelievable movie because it's like one part romance, one part sci-fi, one part body horror. Mm-hmm. It does them all really well and very clearly, which is tough because I see a lot of movies today that try to pull off multiple things, but it leaves you feeling muddled and like not really sure what it was supposed to be.
Kind of like the movie we saw last night.
Kind of like the movie. That's what really kind of brought it up. Yeah.
I was literally about to say, I saw it on Sunday and I was about to say the same thing.
Yep. It's like, it leaves me not knowing what it's trying to do. So many things. At least when I know The Fly does multiple things and does them all great. And it's a very fun movie for anyone who's never seen it. It's been a little bit forgotten. It's a heavy recommend.
Yeah, Fly is sweet.
Unreal's great.
Max, you're number five?
Yeah, so I wanted to give myself sort of a different parameter for this one, just for fun, just for shits and giggles. So I'm going to go, my top five is in an order for the first time. A lot of times I just sort of generally say it. I think my top five this time is in order of how much better it is than the one it is based on.
That's my fun parameter, yeah.
That's my fun, cool little thing, which is going to allow me to place in my number five spot. This is one of the main reasons I did this, so that it doesn't just be number one, Ocean's 11. Ocean's 11 is number five on my list, not because I think that it is the fifth best movie of this list of five movies, but because the original Ocean's 11 has interesting bits and bobs and will still be possibly watched in 50 or 100 years. But Ocean's 11, the remake, is every possible thing you could want from a remake. The music is great. The casting is great. They give honor to something while also making it for a new time period. It also happens to be just an unbelievably enjoyable movie. I would watch it literally right now. I don't have to say really a lot more than it. It's Ocean's 11.
Yeah, I really like it. That's an honorable mention for me, only because we've talked about it on like the last three episodes, so I didn't want to be talking about it again, but it really should be on any list of best remakes.
Yeah, that's an honorable mention for me too, if we're gonna go ahead and say it. Yeah, right up there. I don't have a, I think there's two different kinds of remakes. I think there's remakes that are really fun and they kind of introduce movies to a new audience or what they're supposed to be, and they sort of update them. And there's remakes that totally reimagine a premise and what it can be and make it so much better. And I throw Ocean's 11 in the latter category there. And I think it does a really good job of that.
I think that's an awesome way of putting it. I completely agree.
All right. My number four is 310 to Yuma.
Nice.
Which I think is a pretty good 50s movie with is it Glenn Ford and who's the bad guy in that one? Glenn Ford's the bad guy. Oh, Van Heflin is the good guy, and Glenn Ford is the bad guy.
It's pronounced Van Helsing. Thank you.
Yeah, Victor Van Helsing is the bad guy. And I think James Mangold made a really good modern Western. Really, one of the best Westerns made this century so far. Not that there's that many, but I really like the remake. Christian Bale and Russell Crowe are great casting calls, great pair.
Ben Foster,
that's a really enjoyable Ben Foster
kills that movie. Made me a Ben Foster like super fan. I will watch him do anything because of his role in that.
I think that was the first time he really registered to me as well. Cool score, Marco Bellatrami, I think, as well. But yeah, and did a good job of like in an era where like we don't really make Westerns, just like bringing in a mass audience being like, oh, don't worry, like it's an action movie still. we're going to deliver on the action beats. I like that movie a lot. Great update of a classic film.
Number four for me is The Ring.
I was wondering if you were going to say that because you're foreign.
Obviously based on the Japanese Ringu, it's probably the first of that wave of American horror movies that are based on Japanese originals.
Look, we all know you're paranoid. Walter Parks is listening to this, so you gotta say the Ring and Minority Report.
Hey, that's not a remake. Yeah. Even aside from work stuff, The Ring is one of the most lasting movies for me ever. Just I saw it in theaters as a kid and was just so scared.
What?
Yeah, I saw it. I don't know what my mom was thinking.
We were not that young when it came out. I was
12 when it came out.
That was a PG-13, yeah. We weren't like 5.
Well, my mom thought because it was a PG-13, it wasn't going to be that scary.
It's not about the rating. Yeah. I don't trust the rating system.
That's how they got around. That was a big trick in the early 2000s. They started to realize as long as you don't have gore or violence, you can get away with PG-13. But the movie is so freaking disturbing.
That movie is not a children's movie.
No 13-year-old should ever see that movie. Yes, no 12-year-old should definitely never see that movie.
My dad saw that movie and he was like, hey, just to let you know, he was like, you could maybe watch this movie. He was like, your younger sister is not allowed to watch this movie. If she wants to, don't let her.
Yeah.
Like,
it is such a disturbing movie for a 12-year-old to see for so many reasons. And it has a very lasting impact on me. So I'm putting it, that has to be in my top five.
It's a really solid movie. I just wondering for both of you, like, what age do you think you were when, like, obviously you couldn't drive yet. Like, what age were you when your mom or your dad would, like, drop you off at the mall and be like, just go to the movies? Or, like, or
jokes
you wanted
you,
to go to a movie?
I still can't drive.
I'm just saying, zing. What age could you go to the movies by yourself or, like, with a friend?
Oh, probably... right around 12, that time 13 12 yeah, 13 like 14 that. For some reason I saw it with my mom and my brother. I think she just thought it was like some random, I think she just wanted to kill some time. It's like, oh, we'll go see a movie or something, like,
yeah,
thinking, oh, it's PG-13, you know.
Yeah,
my version of that is seeing Anchorman with my incredibly Mormon grandmother. So I was sitting bare inches from a woman whose mortal soul believes that everything you do on earth manifests in heaven, as Will Ferrell said, a whale's vagina.
Yeah, they've lost the translation.
Yeah.
I guess my version of that is seeing snakes on a plane, and we're too, like, the theaters around me would really go hard on carding you. So, like, you know, we were 15 when that came out. Our parents did give a shit if we watched that, but we needed a parent to get us into that theater. We're like, please see Snakes on a Plane with us to meet my friend and hilarious. His mom watching Snakes on a Plane.
Yeah. I think for me, The Ring stands out just because it was so freaking scary. Like, I think I snuck into Old School at the same time, or that probably came out pretty close to that movie.
Was The Ring 2002? Yeah, I think Old School's 03. Same.
So
time,
yeah, maybe a year later.
Let me put it this way: it's the same world in which the fact that The Sixth Sense is a PG-13 movie.
Yeah,
a 12 or 13-year-old should not see that fucking movie.
And I saw that when it came out with my mom and my uncle.
That movie
to kill time
scarred
again.
Me. That movie literally scarred me for maybe 10 years.
Yeah. I think the thing that movie was very scary. It got me very scared to leave my room to go to the bathroom at night. I think the one thing about that movie as opposed to The Ring is it has like a really happy, or like a, not happy, but a nice, wholesome ending to it where you're
sure.
like,
true.
Oh, there's a little like, he's grown, the child's grown, and he's learned. And The Ring's just horrible the whole way through. And the ending, quite frankly, is also horrible. The ending, there's no resolution. It's like, okay, the main character gets out because they make a copy of the tape or something. It's like, someone could still watch the tape right now. And it would be... and they would be have 7 days to live. And also just the scene with what's her name in the closet, Amber Tamblyn.
Yeah.
That was just so disturbing. Ugh.
Max, number 4.
Right. I forgot where this is lists and not just talking about movies that scarred us as children. My number 4, a film oft forgotten that it is a remake, and a film that has already been remade again. It's a fun twofer. This would be a very fun, very difficult trivia question for a trivia night. It is about a certain man named Lawrence Jameson. My number 4 is Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Oh,
It is one of my all-time favorite films.
I have no comment.
So what's shut your dirty mouth, apparently, because you're apparently going to make me mad, but without
there's a reason for that.
It is based on a 1964 Marlon Brando David Niven film called Bedtime Story.
I was not aware of that.
And there is a remake of it from 2019 that is The Hustle. A little
number called The Hustle. Yeah.
A little number called The Hustle. Now, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels is one of my favorite comedies of all time. It is Steve Martin and Michael Caine being just at their best, at their utmost, from a comedic standpoint. It is a powerhouse film with a very fun script. A movie that came out at a time period where it was not normal for there to be a love story where the woman gets to come out on top. And holy shit, I won't spoil it for anyone, but when it comes to a film that empowers women, this is definitely one of them. This movie's great. I love this movie.
I'm going to break up the order here, and just because I want to say this, that is my number three movie, so...
Yes! Thank you.
I love that movie so much.
I was so worried that you were going to be like, I hate that film. This is one of my favorite movies. I quote it weekly.
Yeah. So that's number three. Everything you said about it's great. I agree 100%. So I just wanted to, I had to comment. I was too excited because most people don't know that's a remake, and it's one of the all-time classics.
Yes.
I'm just so happy you're going to have him walking again. Oh, I will have him running and jumping and screaming.
My mother and I, anytime that we cannot remember someone's name, we will say, James Jesterton, yeah. Lawrence Fisterton.
Rupert, just, we're going to Oklahoma.
I just saw...
Oklahoma.
So I just saw Steve Martin and Martin Short at the Hollywood Bowl last weekend, and they showed they had a very long video intro of clips from both of their careers, and of course they showed Rupert at the table with forking his cork into his eye.
May I take your trident, sir?
Yeah, that's maybe one of the hardest times I can remember laughing as a kid is Steve Martin like walking to the like priceless like vases and just tipping them off the shelf.
So good.
Even the subtle stuff late in the movie when all the different sailors are leaving the party, yeah. and he's standing there and Michael Caine comes to get him and he's been glued to the wall. Everything about that movie is perfect. His acting in the scene where he is making up the horror story of his girlfriend leaving him on the set of Saturday Night Fever. That movie's perfect. That is a perfect film. That is a 10 out of 10 movie.
It's a 10 out of 10. Yeah.
So my number three is 1978's Invasion of the Body Snatchers by Philip Kaufman. Also one of IBS. The three timers club. Yeah, IBS as we call it. And the three timers club, like King Kong and some other movies, been done a bunch of times. I really like the 50s movies as well, and I think, like you said, for Thomas Crown, Max, I think Invasion of the Body Snatchers is something like you really can do again, and they have, you know, there are a bunch of movies, you know, they did it directly most recently, I think, with Invasion with Nicole Kidman and Daniel Craig, which I have not seen. I don't think was supposed to be very good, but there's a bunch of movies that are just like soft remakes of body snatchers, like The Faculty or The World's End, that are just body snatchers basically, and you can always kind of apply whatever we're afraid of today to a story like that, and a fantastic job in the 70s with Donald Sutherland and what's her name from Days of Heaven. Spacing on the actress, but really good movie. I like it a lot.
Nice. My number three, staying on again, just the theme of better than the original. Is this is a little unfair because I have not seen the original, but mine's 310 to Yuma. I adore 310 to Yuma. I think it's a very good movie.
By virtue
of the fact that I haven't seen the original, and I think that probably 90% of the people that saw and loved 310 to Yuma have never seen the original, it has my number three spot.
The original, I guess, kind of spoilers for people who haven't seen the new one, but the original happy ending that does not feel earned, kind of. Whereas the newer one,
they missed the 310, but there's a 315. Is that the ending?
Yeah, but it's not an IMAX and it sucks.
The newer one has sacrifice that feels appropriate to how insane the odds that are stacked against them. The whole movie. Is it me?
Yeah, it's you.
All right, my number two is The Departed. We already talked about it.
The Departed.
Matt Damon episode, but it's awesome, and it's a really good. You know, I don't want to talk about movies too many times on here, but like it, just speaking as a remake, it's really awesome. In that, I think I've seen Infernal Affairs. It's a very strong film. I don't know if I'll watch it again because it would feel a tiny bit like watching Never Say Never Again and feeling like I could be watching Thunderball. Where like there's just it's a really good thriller, Infernal Affairs, but Departed just adds like 40 minutes of screen time, which you'd think would be a bad thing, but instead of
necessary,
you know,
yeah.
Well, it just gives it so much more personality and life and character, and great characters, great dark comedy, and still is a long movie that maintains great tension throughout.
I have no comment. Moving on to my number two.
Yeah.
Is The Thing, which is based on The Thing from Another World from the 50s. It's, Max, to speak of your thing about movies that are, the remake is vastly superior to the original. I probably watched the original Thing from Another Planet, I don't know, maybe 9-10 years ago with my brother, just to sort of remember it, and wow, have they never made a remake better than that. I think that movie is very boring, very bad. The Thing is an all-time classic horror movie. The effects, unbelievable. The writing is just unbelievable to dial up all that tension so well in such a closed environment. It's basically like a, I don't know any other way to describe it, like a bottle episode of a TV show, or it's a total A story movie. It's some guys in a camp in Antarctica or whatever. Mm-hmm. They have nowhere to go and they're just stuck here. It's a great, great movie. One of the all time great remakes. Topped only by one other one for me.
My number two is The Italian Job, baby.
Nice.
I will ride or die for this film. I love this film. It is a film so good it brought a car company back from the brink. This movie was so fun and so good that Mini Cooper literally was able to have a second life. They opened up dealerships after this movie. The score is fantastic. The cast is fun. It is. It will come up again because I also think that it is one of my all-time favorite heist movies.
Yep, it's. Yeah, well, go on. What's number one for you? That's going to be my honorable mention. So I don't know how much I want to say now.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, Italian Job's in my honorable mentions. So.
Yeah. Go ahead. Say your number one, and then we'll do Road Warrior. We'll do your honorable mentions and your number one, and then we'll do my honorable.
Oh yeah.
Unless we want to all do honorable mentions.
We can
now.
Let's do all our honorable mentions. Yeah. Okay.
That
feels a little more fun.
Nice.
Yeah. So I have the Fly and the Italian Job, of course, as honorable mentions.
It's got Handsome Rob, baby.
Yeah, didn't realize until recently that Heat is kind of a remake of a TV movie.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, didn't feel...
I'm not throwing that on
there. Didn't feel qualifying to me, but that's a gray area one where, like, shout out to Heat, great movie, obviously. Another gray area, because I think it's also a novel, is Ben-Hur. I do like the 50s Ben-Hur. It's a little uneven. It's a little slow at times. The chariot race is amazing.
Well, they made like a Ben-Hur in the late 20s, right? Or early?
I was about to say, a lot of those classic stories.
It's more of a remake
of the 20s movie.
Because it's one of those things where by the turn of the same coin, Wizard of Oz is a remake because they made like six of them before the one that we all like. But it doesn't. Right. It's because it was a different time.
But because there's a book, I'm saying that's different kind of because they're not. It's not like people went to see that because they're like, oh, it's related to the other movie.
Sure.
And then. A movie I feel like might be coming up in a minute, The Mummy, which is a pretty fun movie that I feel like if I had to guess what your two guys are about to say, I think it's The Departed and The Mummy.
what?
Any more?
The Mummy, I just totally forgot about it. I'm sorry. That's a huge oversight on my part. I got to rethink this whole list now, but we'll stay the course.
Okay, your honorable mentions?
My honorable mentions, we already talked about Ocean's 11. That's obviously on there. Italian Job is on mine. Again, just a great movie. Super fun. Kind of, I think it's interesting. It feels a little bit like it lives of the era of Thomas Crown. It's just kind of a fun heist movie. Probably a little bit more action than that. But it's a late 90s, early 2000s movie. It's like super fun. I would say Dawn of the Dead.
Oh yeah,
Is one that I really, really love. I think it's vastly superior to the original, and Zack Snyder's probably the only, I'm not going to say great, but really fun, enjoyable movie. Scarface, for obvious reasons.
Sure, yep.
I forgot about that, but yeah I think, Scarface,
you know,
fun.
And last, Cape Fear is a fun movie.
I'd written that down too and forgot about it. I think also probably superior to the 60s one.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess I have to throw The Mummy on there now. The Mummy would probably be in my top five if I redid it, but let's throw it in the honorable mentions for now.
Yeah, the heist genre is just ripe for remakes, because like you were saying, for Thomas Crown, you can kind of make those kind of movies in for any generation with, we're just going to different actors and locations and different things that we're stealing, like that's a formula that always works.
Yeah, I
love heist movies. I honestly, and I actually was thinking about it, I can't think of the last great heist movie to come out. And you know the answer is it's Endgame. It's the time heist.
Time heist, yeah.
Yeah, which is an interesting dichotomy.
You know, file this under many movies that are ripoffs of Heat, but. I'll count myself part of the Den of Thieves cult. Pretty enjoyable movie. I liked it.
Y'all have a cult? All seven of you guys have a cult? It's great. Good for you.
There are dozens of us.
Riveting meetings. My honorable mentions. This is a James Bond podcast. Casino Royale is my honorable mention. My honorable mentions include The Thing, not because it deserves to be an honorable mention, but because, as I said, my list was predominantly based on how good you are versus what you're based on. And I think the original is slow. I do not think it's bad, personally.
Uh-huh.
I will say it has it's in the mid to high 80s on Rotten Tomatoes. So at the time it was very well accepted. Whereas some other stuff is less so, like A Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. The Departed, amazing, fantastic, adore it. The only reason it's not on my top five, again, as I said. And then one that if it's not one of y'all's number one, and one of you it's not even on your list, I'm wondering if it's just because you don't consider it a remake. The Magnificent Seven.
I'm going to consider that. That was a bridge to... Maybe a bridge
is it,
a
though?
Little too far for me, yeah.
Because it is, it's just that in the U.S. we don't have samurai.
That would have maybe been number one for me, but
would have been my number one if I made a, it and Ocean's 11 would have tied for number one if I made a list.
Okay, because you're saying it less samurai.
Too loose of a... I just thought it, for me, it was a little too loose to put it on there.
I think it can count. Like, it's structurally...
Like, The Departed, they're both cop movies. The thing it's based on, it's still cops. You know what I mean? Like,
sure, but that's just because we... All, by the turn of the same coin, the original thing doesn't take place in Siberia or wherever.
Like, no, they're both in Antarctica, I think.
They're both in Antarctica, yeah.
I am less mistaken.
Yeah, I don't know. For some reason, to me, that was where I think you... An adaptation versus a remake is a very fine line. And that, to me, feels a little bit more like an adaptation of some sort of source material than maybe a straight remake. It's because there's so many cultural differences. The actual, the time and the place and what the people, the main characters do is actually a little bit different. You're right, though, Max. It is a remake, and I throw Fistful of Dollars in there, too.
It toes the line. That's why I'm asking. Yeah. I was about to say, Fistful of Dollars is the last of my honorable mentions slash big umbrella of adaptation versus remake.
I think where it crosses into, like...
And Dinner for Schmucks.
Like, going from Kurosawa into other Western remakes would be like definitely Star Wars is off the table for like Hidden Fortress. Yeah. But yeah, I think Fistful of Dollars or Magnificent Seven, you can count those. Those probably just wouldn't make my top five of personal favorites, but I do like both.
Magnificent Seven would definitely make mine.
It would probably be my number one. Yeah. But... alas, it is not, and we are now here at the time of the number ones.
I'm going for the thing. It is, I think it's that perfect Goldilocks zone for me of a great movie that I love, and also like the best. Like, we're going up more. There's more of a disparity in quality between that and The Thing from Another World than like Departed and Infernal Affairs, in my opinion. I haven't seen it in a long time. I did like The Thing from Another World last time I saw it. It was one of my dad's favorite movies as a kid, so I watched it a couple times as a kid. Carpenter, a legendary special effects movie, just some of the greatest practical Stan Winston makeup things there. Tension, the Ennio Morricone score, everything works in that movie. It's awesome.
Agreed. My number one is obviously The Departed. I think at this point, what more can be said? We've talked about it already. It's great. I don't want to be a product environment. My environment. I want my environment to be a product of me.
Yeah.
Best opening line maybe in the history of movies.
What are you drinking? Cranberry juice?
Yeah.
My number one movie.
We know it's The Mummy.
Is... a film. It came out in 1999.
Yeah, we know.
Thomas Crown Affair.
Yeah, we all know.
Languished for years in production hell. Sandstorms, snake bites.
Thomas Crown Affair.
The cast is a sexuality unto itself. I will watch this film yearly until I die.
You're talking about The Nutty Professor, right?
This film is so special to me that I have plans with a friend of mine to get tattoos from it. I am, of course, talking about Jingle All the Way. No, I'm talking about The Mummy. I'm talking about the 1999's The Mummy, starring Brendan Fraser and Rachel Weisz. I am talking about... the Bembridge Scholars. I'm talking about a film that was so good that it inspired an excellent sequel and another movie. And then inspired a spinoff, and then that spinoff had movies. There was an animated series. The Mummy is one of the last major sort of action location movies that we as a nation have made. It is our Lawrence of Arabia. I cannot stress enough how perfect and wonderful I think that this movie is. I adore The Mummy. I adore The Mummy just in every possible way and in every possible facet. That's about it. That's about what I got. It is perfect.
The Mummy's adorable. I don't know if we can justify covering it on a James Bond podcast, but I'd love to spin off into some sort of general genre podcast eventually and talk about a couple movies like The Mummy. It would be great fun.
I will watch it at any point in time. People that watch it with me, I apologize because I do nothing but quote it. The original, even the music that the original music from it is fantastic. And then in The Mummy Returns, you get Alan Silvestri at his peak, at his best. Alan Silvestri score since is just him trying to be as good as he is in The Mummy Returns.
Really, Jerry Goldsmith's the guy to follow up in big movie franchises where you got, I mean, great score for The Mummy, also great score in Alien, followed up by James Horner for Aliens. Strong stuff.
It's a great movie. I can't believe I forgot it, quite frankly. I'm a little bit upset myself.
I thought that we were going to be like, because it's a remake, but like,
Yeah, it's. I mean, there's not.
I think it's a straight remake of a movie. Like, The Mummy's not based on any other source material. The Universal horror movie.
Sure, yeah, but again, it is the remake in the. It's that funny bit where it's like none of the characters or the plot exist, but the mummy does.
I think both movies. It's the priest Imhotep wants to turn modern woman and is gonna put the soul of his dead girlfriend into a modern woman. So that's. I think that's enough.
I think. But also, too, they're both contemporary in their time of people going to and so resurrecting something from it. There's enough connective tissue there where, like, Magnificent Seven, I just didn't feel that way. But I thought about that. I'm just upset I forgot The Mummy.
I would let Oded Fehr do anything to me. That man. When do I get my Oded Fehr as a James Bond villain? I want it so bad.
Wait, is that the... Ardith
Bay, the Magi.
Yeah.
He would be freaking amazing.
He's also in Deuce Bigelow, Male Gigolo.
he is also in Deuce Bigelow. He, to be very fair to him, he's also in a lot of very, very good TV and foreign work.
I only remember him from Deuce Bigelow, Male Gigolo, other than that, The Mummy. I didn't know his name or anything.
Other things. Okay. I very much know his name, but again, I am a Mummy super fan. If the world ended tomorrow, I might be able to get together with two of my buddies, and we might be able to write word for word both the first and second movie.
Okay, here's a great question, too, because I might not ever have an opportunity to. Do you like Deuce Bigelow Male Gigolo better or Deuce Bigelow European Gigolo better?
I'm waiting for the third one, which is coming out, and it's going to be slated. It's an Apple Plus. It's on Apple only. And it is Deuce Bigelow, Female Gigolo, starring Anne Hathaway and
Rebel Wilson.
And Rebel Wilson, yes.
Female Gigolo is maybe the best phrase ever.
Yes. Deuce
that's
is Bigelow.
That's how we're going to put it.
It's Deucette Bigelow, Female Gigolo.
Max, when was the last time you saw 1932's The Mummy with Boris Karloff?
Literally never.
It's pretty slow. I mean, it's worth watching at some point, and it's, you know, like a lot of those Universal old movies, like Frankenstein and the Wolfman, it's like an hour and 10 minutes.
Yeah, so, it's pretty much just like wait for the... I mean, I obviously love everything that he's ever done, but it is very much just like do the setup, let him show up, and then like you're sort of good.
Yeah, Boris Karloff's got cool makeup in it. He is very creepy. Not an amazing movie, but the one thing that stuck out to me that I think carried into the 99 movie, pretty strong female character. You have this woman who is a damsel a little bit, and then the end of that movie is, you know, you're waiting basically for the guys to run in and save her from the, like, sacrifice and, you know, magic process thing. But they don't get there in time, and she has to save herself, which is pretty cool.
She saves herself, and then they can't even send him back because Jonathan can't read the damn book. He says, it's a bird, a stork, and while fighting, she has to yell back that it's a Menephis. Fuck, I love that movie.
Awesome. So cool.
It's so good. Everything.
Can we pull that out of the
it.
Bag next?
Where's Benny? I love Benny.
love the whole trick with the sand, and that was beautiful. The bastard.
Bastards.
Shit. All right, I got this bag full of movies that I think are related to James Bond. The Mummy's not in here.
But
with that, it works.
I think we asked that it was in there.
No, there's something else that was more connected that we asked.
Oh, this is kind of a fun one. We might like this.
Sup?
Kingsman.
Ooh, oh, yeah. Hell yeah. You know what? That's good. We're going to go from like a movie that was so bad it wasn't funny to a movie that was a little funny to finally something that is it legitimately has some ha-ha moments.
Now, you wrote Kingsman. Are we talking about...
Well, I think that's how it's spelled in all three. Or wait, no, the new one was...
The new
King
one is
apostrophe.
The Kingsman.
Yeah, the new one is The King's Man. The first two are spelled that way.
Really?
I believe so.
Wow.
It is.
But I just put three
the
cards in there that say Kingsman.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, the first one is Kingsman, the Secret Service.
Yeah.
And then we're obviously watching Rocket Man after that.
Yeah, we're pivoting into a Taron Egerton podcast. We're doing all the Robin
Eagle.
Hood's Eddie the Eagle.
Yeah.
We're doing the Blackbird on Apple TV.
We're going to T-Town, and I'm not talking about Tinseltown. From yeah. Perfect. Talking about Taron Town.
Then we can go into the Strongverse, do all the Mark Strong films, which
would
be a lot
love
of good
going
movies.
Into the... If we could just watch every episode of Low Winter Sun on AMC, I'd take that too as a podcast.
Perfect.
Okay, well...
I've never watched it, but I would like to watch it someday.
Thank you to everyone who listened to this. Please check out our social media and like and subscribe and rate and review and all that good stuff. And we'll see you very soon for a discussion on 2015's Kingsman: The Secret Service by Matthew Vaughn. We'll be right back.